Once he was considered untouchable, but next week former Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship is facing trial for conspiracy to violate mine safety standards and conspiracy to impede federal mine safety officials. The charges stem from an investigation that followed the Upper Big Branch disaster that killed 29 men in 2010. It's news that folks in the coalfields never thought would happen. In this episode, we'll take a look back at how we got here and talk about the significance of this case. We'll also hear part of a special investigative series of reports about outlaw coal mining companies that keep operating despite injuries, violations, and millions in fines. Mary Middleton was 31 when she became a coal miner's widow.
People would say to me, well, now Mary, accidents can happen. You can just be walking in the yard and, you know, fall over dead or get hurt, which, I mean, you know, I know that's true.
Stick around for this special episode about mine safety and a look ahead at the upcoming trial of Don Blankenship. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly.
I don't care what people think. You know, at the end of the day, Don Blankenship is going to die with more money than he needs.
Jury selection for the trial of former CEO of Massey Energy is expected to begin on October 1st. On today's show, we're going to talk about mine safety, the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, and just how significant this case is. You see, coal mining is part of Appalachian culture that goes as deep as some of the seams snaking through the rolling hills that surround us. Unfortunately, so is the heartache that comes after losing a friend, a son, a husband, or a father to mine accidents.
On the fifth day of April 2010, death came looking for 29 men and took away the spirits like a feather in the wind
in Montcalm, West Virginia.
The largest mine disaster in more than 40 years happened in Montcalm, West Virginia, in 2010. Mine safety officials at the time hosted a news conference on April 5, 2010, just as the rescue operation was underway for the Upper Big Branch mine disaster.
Two previous attempts have taken care of a lot of the exploration part of mine rescue operations, as well as delivering a lot of equipment to the areas that we need to visit.
This is going to be a longer process when the bodies are beginning to be recovered. It's a lot of work.
When the story broke, I had been a reporter for West Virginia Public Broadcasting for about a year and a half. During that time, I had taken special interest in the coal industry and mine safety. Some of the men who died were from my hometown. I went to school with one of the youngest victims, Nick McCroskey. But even before that, I knew myself the personal anguish and terror that comes with losing a loved one in a violent accident. And really, it never goes away. I knew that someone had lost their brother, their husband, their friend, their daddy, and I wanted to make sure the world knew how important these lives were and that they would never be forgotten. Michelle McKinney lost her father, Benny Willingham. I remember being with her and the family as they planned his funeral. She went through pictures and shared memories of her Easter dinner, the last meal they had together. And I remember talking with Gary and Patty Quarles. They lost their son, Gary Wayne Quarles, in the blast. 2 years after the disaster, they still could recall the nightmare of that day.
She said, "If I call your name, you are to report to Watchville Fire Department to identify bodies."
And just as though she was talking about naming your cattle. I mean, that's exactly what she said. No, just come and identify your bodies.
When names started to be naming, there was people falling on the floor.
We'll hear more from Gary and Patty Quarles later in the show. An independent investigation into the Upper Big Branch disaster concluded that it was a failure of basic coal mine safety procedures that claimed the lives of 29 men. A team led by the former head of the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration found mining company Massey Energy to be negligent, but also criticized the oversight by the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration and the West Virginia State Office of Miners' Health Safety and Training. The U.S. Attorney's Office closed the non-prosecution agreement with the mine's current owner, Alpha Natural Resources, in regards to the investigation into the Upper Big Branch explosion. As a company, Alpha can't face charges. But the agreement did not let individuals off the hook. That agreement included Alpha building a state-of-the-art mine safety training facility and leadership program. Now, more than 5 years later, former CEO of Massey Energy Don Blankenship is facing trial in federal court. Technically, he's not charged with causing the Upper Big Branch disaster. He's accused of conspiring to violate mine safety standards and conspiring to impede mine safety officials. The indictment alleges that Blankenship conspired to commit and cause routine, willful violations of mandatory federal mine safety and health standards, along with three other federal counts. The charges carry a maximum penalty of 31 years in prison. Blankenship and his lawyers are not commenting publicly on the eve of the trial. But shortly after Blankenship was indicted last November, his attorney, William Taylor, issued a statement saying his client was innocent of the charges. Taylor called Blankenship a tireless advocate for mine safety. Taylor also said the indictment was a result of Blankenship's criticism of lawmakers and regulators. Blankenship has long maintained that he did nothing wrong and that safety was a priority at his operations. In 2013, the Charleston Gazette reported that Blankenship wrote a blog post, quote, "If they put me behind bars, it will be political." The indictment of Blankenship says that he knew the mines owned by Massey, including Upper Big Branch, were committing hundreds of safety law violations every year. Steve Morgan testified before Congress just 2 months after he lost his son, Adam Morgan, in the blast.
I said, tell them you think it's unsafe and you want to be put out by in a safer area, go to the trainee, see what they tell you. The boss pulled him to the side there by himself and told him, said, if you're going to be that scared of your job, or you need to rethink your career.
There were two survivors of the disaster. One of them was Stanley Goose Stewart. He spoke with me in 2012.
Working under Massey, they didn't care. For some reason, they seemed like that was in their agenda. To just break the rules, and they didn't have to follow the law. They had a mentality that the laws were stupid. That's my take on it.
Federal investigators have spent years since the blast looking at the actions of Massey's leaders, working their way up the corporate ladder. Former Upper Big Branch Superintendent Gary May cooperated with prosecutors and admitted in March 2012 to defrauding the government by tampering with methane monitors and falsifying documents. In 2013, former president of White Buck Coal Company David Hugert admitted to working with others to ensure that his mine and others owned by Massey would have advanced warnings of federal inspectors. Blankenship is the highest-level manager to face charges in relation to mine safety violations. But just how significant is this case? Tony Opegard has been representing miners and their families for about 30 years. He also served as advisor to the Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration. I chatted with Tony this week to find out.
Well, it's historic in that Blankenship is the highest-level coal executive ever to be indicted for criminal charges and probably will be going to trial. But even though it's historic, I'm not sure how important it is in terms of mine safety, just because the coal industry is a dying industry in my view. And it's reminds me of an old miner with black lungs sort of on gasping for his last breath. And I think that's probably an accurate assessment of where the coal industry is right now. Had this indictment happened 10 years ago or 15 years ago when coal was booming and a lot of miners were working, I think it would have had a far greater impact than it will now.
Still, folks in the coal fields are watching this case closely, and Tony Opegard says he expects they have mixed feelings.
Well, Blankenship is a very polarizing figure, and I think there's people who despise him and look at him as being representative of everything that's wrong with the coal industry in terms of greed and abuse of power, abuse of people. And on the other hand, you have people who look at him as a homegrown boy who did well and knew how to play the game, knew how to use the system to amass great wealth, and in doing that provided people with jobs.
Blankenship has been a controversial figure for years, even before the Upper Big Branch disaster. He's a West Virginia native, born in 1950 and raised by his mother in Mingo County. He attended Marshall University, and during the summer, he washed cars and worked in the coal mines to pay tuition. Eventually, he earned a CPA certification. In 1982, he started to work for Massey Coal Company and quickly moved his way up the corporate ladder. While he was CEO of Massey Energy, he lived in the coal fields, unlike most coal operators.
When I was growing up, I would hear about, people would say something about so-and-so made his money and left, you know, and I've heard that all my life, but Don, he's still here.
The former mayor of Matewan, West Virginia, Johnny Fullen, praised Blankenship in a film by West Virginia Public Broadcasting that originally aired back in 2005 called The Kingmaker. It profiled Don Blankenship.
I don't have anything bad to say about the man. I know what he's done, and I've witnessed it. The town of Matewan, where I'm from, has been the recipient of some of his generosity, but the whole area has.
For those people who look at Blankenship as a positive figure in the community, that you have to realize that those jobs come with a heavy price.
This is Tony Opegard again. He says that Blankenship's business practices made working in Massey Mines unsafe for many miners.
I believe that the companies he ran, Massey in particular, was an outlaw company that regularly violated the law. So although particularly men had jobs in the mines, you know, so many of them are going to retire someday with black lung disease and with various other ailments that working in the mines cause. Even in the when they did the autopsies of the Upper Big Branch miners, so many of them already had contracted black lung disease at an early age. So what I'm trying to say is that even though Massey provided jobs, Blankenship provided jobs, they came with a very heavy price. And I also think to work in a Massey mine, if you're a coal miner, you had to accept the fact that there was going to be safety violations. You were going to be at greater risk than you should have to be to hold a job. But if you wanted to keep those jobs, you really couldn't speak out, because if you would speak out, then Massey was going to get rid of you. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't have a whole lot good to say about Mr. Blankenship. I think he's a ruthless, amoral CEO that only cared about the bottom line and making himself rich, which he was very successful at. But I think a lot of people paid the price because of his greed.
The year before the blast that killed 29 men, MSHA issued more than 500 citations at the Upper Big Branch mine. From 2006 until around the time of the blast, MSHA issued about $1.8 million in penalties, of which the company only paid about $365,000. So, did anything change after the Upper Big Branch disaster that made working in the coal mines any safer? Well, Tony Opegard points out there was no federal legislation that passed to improve mine safety since the blast.
Well, I think it's an indictment of our politicians that you could have the worst mining disaster in 40 years in America, and absolutely nothing is done by the political leaders afterwards to try to make the mine safer. I really think it's a grievous wrong to coal miners.
That was Tony Opegard, an attorney from Kentucky who has represented miners and their families for about 30 years. He also served as advisor to the Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration. We'll hear from him again in our next story. So Tony Opegard is saying there should be more federal regulations for coal mines. But an investigation last year by NPR and Mine Safety and Health News revealed that some regulations already on the books aren't having the intended impact. Coal mines are some of the nation's most dangerous places to work. Federal regulators issue citations and fines when mines violate safety standards. That's supposed to discourage unsafe practices by making them expensive. The joint investigation found part of that system isn't working. Thousands of miners are still put at risk of serious injury and even death. Here's Howard Berkus's story that first aired in 2014.
Mary Middleton was 31 when she became a coal miner's widow. 8 years later, she's still frustrated with a regulatory system that failed to protect her husband and four others who died at the Kentucky Derby mine. A federal accident report blamed serious safety hazards. Fines topped $500,000, but federal regulators didn't make the mining company pay.
Gosh, it's like, just like they died in vain, you know, like their life, it didn't matter. You know, I'm thinking you get a speeding ticket or something and don't pay it and they'll want to put you in jail. But this man, it's people's lives and injuries. And then they just keep letting him keep doing it and doing it. I can't understand it, you know.
The co-owner of the mine also controlled eight other mines, federal mine safety records show, even after he and his partners failed to pay the fines for the deaths at Kentucky Derby. The other mines were cited for 1,300 more violations, according to Labor Department data. New fines totaled $2.4 million, which also went unpaid.
Where is the breaking point, you know? I mean, I know the Bible says vengeance is God's, he will repay. But you think, why are they not being punished?
They have plenty of company, according to multiple sets of federal data and records analyzed by NPR. We obtained the Mine Safety and Health Administration's detailed accounting of mines with overdue safety fines. We then compared those records to 20 years of Labor Department data showing mine injuries and violations. And here's what we found. 2,700 mine owners owe nearly $70 million in delinquent safety fines. Most are years overdue. Some go back decades. And get this, those mines with delinquent fines, they're more dangerous than the mines that do pay, with an average injury rate 50% higher. Middleton remembers how her family was affected by playing this old Christmas home video with a singing Elvis soundtrack. This was almost 9 years ago, the last time the Middleton family was whole at the holidays. Elvis blasted from the stereo, Mary baked cookies in the kitchen, daughters Natalie and Danielle danced in jammies at the Christmas tree. Danielle was 13 then, and she remembers her dad, Roy, behind the camera, as happy as ever.
And I know he always worked especially hard, overtime hours and things, to make sure that we had what we wanted under the tree.
Danielle also has this indelible memory, embracing her dad when he arrived home from work from the mine.
There was not an inch of white beneath all the coal dust. His hands permanently stained from the coal dust, and I can remember just always the scent on his clothes while hugging him. You know, it's just simple things you never think you would miss, but the smell of coal is one of them.
Mountain News Weekend Edition starts now.
WYMT had the news on May 20th, 2006, the day Roy Middleton didn't come home.
We begin tonight with what is believed to be the deadliest mining accident in eastern Kentucky in more than two decades. Five coal miners are dead after an explosion in Harlan County. Maintenance crew was
and yet again, reporters and TV crews, including CNN, flocked to a coal field in crisis.
It did happen again. This weekend, two miners were killed in a blast. Three more died of carbon monoxide poisoning after the blast. And there are accusations now that all of it could have been prevented.
Federal investigators concluded in their report that the owners of the Kentucky Derby mine were highly negligent and showed reckless disregard for safety. Mine managers used inadequate seals that are supposed to keep explosive methane gas out of the mine. They also failed to train miners properly in how to escape accidents. Smoke and carbon monoxide killed Roy Middleton and two others as they struggled to escape. Mary Middleton.
It was so dark in there, and it was so smelly and so smoky, and imagine them trying to breathe, not knowing what to do, where to go. It would just torment me, you know, in my mind, thinking what they went through.
The Kentucky Derby mine never reopened given the damage, but one of the mine's co-owners continued to operate those eight other mines. Those mines reported 20 more injuries, according to mine safety data, and they now owe nearly $3 million in fines for hundreds of violations. They've even defied a federal court order to pay. Just think about that. Ignore parking tickets and they'll boot your car. Ignore tax bills and you could lose your paycheck, your house, and your freedom. but there's little to fear from ignoring the fines that are supposed to keep mine workers safe.
To the scofflaws, to the people who continue to run an operation that puts people at risk on a daily basis, this is a bonanza.
Davitt McAteer was the federal mine safety chief in the 1990s. He later became a prominent mine safety advocate and led independent investigations of three recent coal mine disasters. Even he was shocked by our findings. We counted 4,000 injuries and 130,000 violations at mines while they were delinquent.
This is to them, I can beat the system. And absolutely, this is the kind of attitude that leads to mine disasters.
These are the kinds of violations that put miners in danger, according to federal inspectors. They concluded in their citations that 40,000 violations were likely to cause serious injury or illness if uncorrected.
These categories suggest that there is a direct correlation between injuries and violations. That's why you put money on it, to try to connect those two things together.
And to make violations expensive. Every violation must be corrected. But McAteer notes that mine conditions change every shift. Threats reappear. A fixed problem may not stay fixed for long. We also found that most mining companies do pay their fines, often after challenges and appeals. But when the fines are final, most pay on time. Congressman George Miller of California is the ranking Democrat on the House Labor Committee.
There are many, many mine owners that operate every day within the law. If they fine, they pay their fines, they make the improvements in the mine, and they move on. These are a group of people who've chosen not to do that. They're essentially outlaw miners.
7% of mine owners haven't paid their fines, according to our analysis. Most of the top delinquents did not respond to our request for comment. We also went to the National Mining Association, the industry lobbying group. It declined interview requests, but said in a written statement that all truly delinquent fines should be paid. This is not an industry issue, the group added. It's a government issue. Well, the government's top mine safety regulator is Assistant Secretary of Labor Joe Maine.
I don't want folks who hear this to think that this is an agency that doesn't care about mine operators paying the fines. That is absolutely not true. But we have to place our priorities where they're most impacting, and it's going to be protecting that miner that's out there at risk today.
Many delinquent mines eventually close, Maine says, due to market conditions or tough enforcement. So regulators focus more on troubled mines, delinquent or not, that are still operating. That includes unannounced blitz inspections. More than 300 of those, nearly 40% of the total, have targeted delinquent mines. Repeat violators get even more scrutiny and harsher sanctions. Maine says he's doing what he can with the authority he has.
You can't just shut down a mine because you don't like them or because they have an injury. You have to have the fact of law behind you.
You don't have the authority to shut a mine down simply because it's not paying its penalties.
I think that's a matter of law. We have no silver bullet. I mean, we don't have the authority to go in and just to shut down a mine because of X.
Even if a mine is delinquent, it can continue to operate. And Labor Department data shows that delinquent mines continue to violate the law and put miners at risk over and over again, sometimes for years. Now, the Mine Safety Agency does close mines temporarily for dangerous conditions, but once those are fixed, the mine reopens. That happened 2 years ago at one of the mines operated by some of the owners of Kentucky Derby. It reopened in 6 days, according to federal records. The fines that resulted were never paid and violations continued.
When you don't pay your fines, there's a breakdown in the system, and there's no accountability.
Tony Opegard is a former state and federal mine safety regulator and an attorney who represents miners and their families. He represented Mary Middleton during the Kentucky Derby investigation.
If I don't have to pay a fine, what incentive do I have to provide a safe workplace? I'm going to do it as cheaply as I can. I'm going to cut as many corners as I can to make as much money as possible.
State and federal records list Ralph Napier Sr. as Kentucky Derby's co-owner and legally responsible corporate official. We knocked on the doors of two homes in a subdivision outside Harlan, Kentucky. Neighbors and county records indicate Napier and relatives lived in both. We left notes when no one answered, but we also tried to reach Napier through two of his attorneys and his son. Napier didn't respond. His mines are either closed or operated by others now. But while they were open and delinquent, they produced 1.4 million tons of coal,
That's almost $90 million worth, based on average prices in that part of Kentucky at the time. Congressman Miller.
These are not onerous fines on the operation of the mine. If the mine is open, the mine's making a profit. So clean up the mine, make it safe, and pay your fine and continue doing your business.
2 years ago, Miller demanded an explanation and a payment plan from Napier and his partners. Their attorney wrote that they didn't have the ability to pay. They spent their money, he said, on salaries, benefits, operating costs, and mine safety. All this baffles Tracy Stumbo, who spent 17 years as Kentucky's chief mine accident investigator.
To me, it's almost unbelievable that you could have a horrendous accident such as Kentucky Derby, an explosion that would kill five people, and still the company would be able to still mine coal in the state of Kentucky and not pay their fines. That's almost unbelievable to me. And, you know, it's pretty hard to explain to the families why this continues to go on.
Stumbo investigated the Kentucky Derby disaster and briefed widow Mary Middleton.
People would say to me, well, no, Mary, accidents can happen. You can just be walking in the yard and, you know, fall over dead or get hurt, which, I mean, you know, I know that's true. But you think if someone's got it in their power to help make things safer, you know, maybe save a life, you know, that's what they should be doing.
18 miles from the Middleton home, thin curtains of water cascade off a coal-colored cliff. Mounds of brush-covered dirt hide what were once the entrances to the Kentucky Derby mine. It seems unlikely that coal will ever come out of this mountain again, but Ralph Napier and his son have registered another mining company with the state of Kentucky. It's not clear whether they'll actually mine coal there. Ralph Napier Jr. declined to talk about it. Still, they'll be able to open another mine if they want to, despite the deadly disaster here and close to $3 million now in delinquent safety fines owed by the other mines. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
I came from a cradle of clear southern pine. You're from across the wide ocean. Do you remember of your former life? I hear it's a garden.
That story first aired last November as part of a special investigation by NPR and Mine Safety and Health News. In that report, we heard that Ralph Napier Sr. and Kentucky Derby's owes close to $3 million. Last November, NPR reported that Ralph Napier had registered another mine in Kentucky. We reached out to MSHA for an update on what's being done to collect these delinquent fines. They say the Derby mine went bankrupt, and MSHA followed bankruptcy procedures, which includes stopping all collection efforts. All Napier Derby mines are abandoned and sealed, and MSHA referred all delinquent debt to the Treasury for collection. The Treasury determined that a portion of the debt was uncollectible. Still, the debt is expected to be treated as taxable income. In addition, MSHA officials point out that their department is not a collection agency. MSHA is required to refer debt that is 120 days old to the Treasury Department, the collection agency for the federal government. The overwhelming majority of the delinquent debt referenced in the NPR story we just heard is currently at the Treasury Department. Mines controlled by Ralph Napier currently have more than $550,000 in delinquent debt, more than $82,000 of which is uncollectible, and about $420,000 is at Treasury for collection. Also, after this series of reports aired on NPR last year, the Inspector General of the Labor Department announced they are conducting an audit of the Mine Safety and Health Administration's Civil Penalties Compliance Office. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're talking about mine safety and about the trial of former Massey CEO Don Blankenship. Jury selection is expected next week. He's charged with conspiring to violate mine safety standards. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about just how significant this case is and much more. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs, to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Next week, former Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship is scheduled to go on trial, charged with conspiring to violate mine safety standards. And so today we've been talking about mine safety and what some people call outlaw mine companies. Coming up, we'll hear what the father of one of the victims of the Upper Big Branch disaster thinks about the prosecution. But first, we're going to focus on the trial itself, the case against Don Blankenship. According to court documents, the prosecution's case basically hinges on proving Blankenship's management style. They need to show that he was behind decisions to violate safety standards. In the film about Blankenship, The Kingmaker, Blankenship's predecessor, E. Morgan Massey, described Blankenship's business approach.
There have been a lot of good people who've worked for Don that have left because, in their opinion, Don didn't give them enough authority. And Don's management style is that of wanting to know everything that's going on and making most of the decisions.
Blankenship himself didn't speak to the producer of the film, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Anna Sale, but The Kingmaker includes video of Blankenship from television commercials and speeches. The documentary was made around a year after Brent Benjamin won a seat on the West Virginia Supreme Court. Blankenship spent more than $3 million to unseat incumbent Warren McGraw. He spent $1 million to influence public policy through TV commercials and ads as he spoke at different events.
What you have to accept in a capitalist society generally is that I always make the comparison, it's like a jungle where a jungle's survival of the fittest. Unions, communities, people, everybody's going to have to learn to accept that in the United States you have a capitalist society and that capitalism from a business viewpoint is survival of the most productive. And you may have a year, 2 years, 5 year periods where lesser productive companies or people have benefit, but in the long term, it's going to be the most productive people who benefit.
That last clip of former CEO Don Blankenship is from an interview with Blankenship from an Apple Shop film, Mine War on Blackberry Creek. On our website, you can find a link to that documentary, and you can watch the entire 30-minute film about Blankenship called The Kingmaker on our website, wvpublic.org. Don Blankenship is now the highest-ranking coal executive ever to be charged with a crime in connection with mine safety violations. West Virginia Public Broadcasting will be covering the trial from jury selection to verdict, and our news team will be bringing our listeners daily updates, both on the air and on our website, wvpublic.org. We'll also be in the coal fields looking to hear what folks have to say about the testimony. Ashton Mara is heading up our trial coverage from Charleston. Ashton sat down this week with two people who have followed the Blankenship case since the beginning. Howard Berkus is an investigative reporter for NPR focusing on coal mine and workplace safety. Also joining Ashton and Howard in this conversation is Mike Hissom. He's a partner at the Charleston law firm Bailey & Glasser and a former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of West Virginia. We'll start with an explanation of the charges against Don Blankenship from Mike Hissom.
Mr. Blankenship is not charged with causing the explosion on April 5th, 2010. He's charged in a three-count indictment that he will go to trial on. The first count of that indictment is that he is charged with participating in a conspiracy to defraud the Mine Safety and Health Administration, known as MSHA. The other two charges in the indictment do stem from the explosion in that they postdate the explosion and focus on statements made to the public and to the Securities and Exchange Commission in public filings about the safety record at MSHA, specifically statements about whether or not Massey condoned violation of MSHA regulations and whether it complied with those regulations. The explosion will be an event in those charges and that the statements that are the subject of those counts follow the explosion. But once again, the government will not have to prove that Mr. Blankenship participated in any direct act that caused the explosion.
Howard, you spend your time investigating workplace safety issues kind of more broadly, including the coal industry. But can you talk to us about the novelty of trying a corporate executive on charges that stem from a workplace disaster? This doesn't always happen.
It's extraordinarily rare to hold a CEO responsible for criminal or civil violations at their companies.
Corporation law protects company executives, and most executives are smart enough to manage their companies in such a way that they don't create a clear trail back to them if there is some questionable or illegal activity. And this is especially true in the mining world. We've had two recent cases involving criminal allegations at mining companies, Massey Energy with the fire at the Aracoma mine in 2006, and Murray Energy and the deadly mine collapse at the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah a few years ago. And both those cases were settled with corporate guilty pleas, but no charges against any of the managers who made the decisions that led to those corporate criminal charges. The same thing happened actually with the Upper Big Branch explosion. And the challenge is to draw direct lines from this alleged criminal behavior of the company and company officials to the highest ranking officials in the company, in this case, you know, Don Blankenship. Prosecutors need a paper trail or an electronic trail, or they need somebody or people inside the company with direct knowledge who are going to testify. And of course, Blankenship's $6 million defense team will work hard to blur any such connections or responsibility that the prosecution attempts to make.
And we'll talk about those connections a little bit more. But Mike, you say that this idea of going after CEOs, that's something that the DOJ just doesn't typically do?
You're right, Ash, and it's not something that they typically do. It is something that this case is extraordinary, not, as Howard says, not only in that it goes to the top of a mining company, which has frankly never been done before, but this is something that's a very important issue for the Obama Justice Department. In fact, earlier this month, there were major announcements from the Attorney General and from the Criminal Division and new guidelines for prosecutors that went out all over the country directing that in white-collar cases, in financial institution cases, in banking cases, that individuals be pursued. That has not historically happened. In the Wall Street cases, in the financial crisis cases, there were not bankers or Wall Street types that were the subject of prosecutions like this. This case is highly unusual in that, and it's really on the front end of that. And it's also doubly extraordinary because this case is being conducted by the local United States Attorney's Office, by Booth Goodwin and his staff, with virtually no involvement from Main Justice in Washington.
So the prosecution in this case is essentially saying that Blankenship was a micromanager, that he had his hand in every aspect of Massey Energy. How does the prosecution prove something like that, Mike?
They're going to start by, in one of the major drawbacks in the prior cases in which federal prosecutors have not been able to go after individuals is, as Howard says, the top of the corporate food chain is often removed and insulated from day-to-day decision-making. What will be different here in this case is that Mr. Blankenship is somewhat legendary for his hands-on decision-making at the Massey mines. And the government is going to have what I think many would describe as a wealth of evidence of individual decisions, even at a very minute level, some of which involving less than $1,000, hundreds of dollars level, that the CEO of a publicly traded coal company was actively involved in and participating in those types of decisions.
And Howard, some of that evidence comes from the Aracoma case.
Well, there's Don Blankenship's deposition in the Aracoma case in which he described his micromanagement of that mine. And then there's also a memo that he sent out that came out in that case. He sent it out to mine managers 3 months before the Aracoma fire in 2006, in which he said, if any of you have been asked to do anything other than run coal, you need to run coal. Coal pays the bills. And then he discouraged key safety tasks in coal mines that can also delay production. There are internal production reports that were uncovered in the investigation of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, in which Blankenship received production reports from every mine to, you know, the foot of how much coal was being mined, how far mining machines moved, what delays there were in mining, for what reasons. And he would send these production reports back to mine managers with questions on them. Why is there this delay? When can we get this moving? And he also was known to have called up mine managers, harangued them, threatened them with the loss of their jobs if they didn't get things moving. And we're expecting to hear direct testimony about that in this trial from Chris Blanchard, who was the president of the subsidiary company that managed Upper Big Branch. He testified before the grand jury about that kind of communication, those kinds of threats, and he's basically the government's inside witness or the one we know about so far?
So, Mike, the first step in this trial is to seat a jury. The case was originally going to be heard in Beckley, but it's since been moved to Charleston, and that opens up the jury pool to more potential jurors. We could see people as far north as Wood County and Parkersburg being brought in to sit on this jury. It's a high-profile case in this state, and that, of course, affects the pool. So will Judge Berger be able to seat a jury in this case?
Ashton, Judge Berger is apparently selecting a jury in this case among a pool of 300 potential jurors. And those would be jurors who typically hear cases in the Charleston or Huntington federal courthouses. It's a broader pool than usual, and as you mentioned, will include a much broader geographic scope than usual. Those jurors have received written questionnaires that they have mailed back to the court, and those have been distributed to the parties but not made public. As far as whether Judge Berger will be able to seat a jury, I think the conventional wisdom would be that she can. In the Enron case in Houston several years ago, which is a sort of common comparison case for this one, the judge in that case had a pool of 100 potential jurors. He seated that jury in a single day. Now, he did that, the judge did, by being aggressive, what I would call aggressive with the jurors, and in asking them questions about whether or not they could hear the evidence, and even though they may have some familiarity with the events, the collapse of Enron in that case, in this case it would be the explosion or Massey or Mr. Blankenship in general, whether or not they could still hear the evidence and follow the judge's instructions and be fair. If Judge Berger takes that approach here, I think that she would be able to seat a jury among that pool of 300 and that she may be able to do so quickly.
Howard, maybe I don't need to ask this question, but how important is who is on that jury?
Oh, it's absolutely critical. Even though the jury pool is not the same jury pool that you would have had in Beckley, you do have people in that region of West Virginia who have a family history of people working in coal mines, people maybe being injured or killed in coal mines. You have relatives of people who may have worked for Massey Energy, may have worked at other coal mines. You have people who are relatives of or themselves may have worked at Massey Energy at their offices south of Charleston. They still have to, that is the prosecution and the defense, still has to sort of root out, you know, prejudice in their questions to prospective jurors. And you have, for example, the prosecution asking the judge if they can ask a question about whether or not, this is the question, please describe any signs, banners, stickers, or other messages displayed on your home, property, or vehicle that pertain to a political, social, or economic issue. Well, that's getting right to the notion of, do you have a Friends of Coal sign on your lawn? Mm-hmm. Do you have a bumper sticker that says War on Coal? And they're trying to root out the notion of whether or not the decline of coal in Appalachia can be blamed on the Obama administration. And this has been something that Don Blankenship has been very vocal about and very aggressive about, and arguing that he's being prosecuted because of his opposition to federal policy and federal regulation. So there'll be an attempt to get at that, as well as whether or not any prospective jurors have worked in coal mines, or for Massey Energy, have relatives, friends, ancestors who are connected to the industry some way, know of somebody or are related to somebody who was injured or killed in a mine. And of course, the bottom line with prospective jurors is they're always asked, can you be fair despite your feelings and beliefs? And we'll see what we end up with after this winnowing process that will take place. And if the jury selection is public, and it typically is, then we'll know a fair amount about these selected jurors and how they answered those questions. Now, Blankenship has moved to keep that process behind closed doors.
And Ashton and Howard, if the jury selection is public, we'll also know a lot about what the respective sides, the prosecution and the defense, think about their best jurors and how they intend to try this case to that chosen jury. One aspect of this case that'll be fascinating if jury selection is public is that the conventional wisdom when this indictment was delivered was that the government brought this case in Beckley, in the Beckley Court Division, because it wanted a coal jury. It wanted a jury that was familiar with Don Blankenship and his reputation in the industry and with Massey and their reputation in the industry. I think we may see, and time will tell. But we may see that the government is trying to find those jurors, as Howard says, who don't have that Friends of Coal sticker, who don't know anything or have any immediate connection to the coal industry, who don't know MSHA as a known quantity as those in the coal country do. Because I think Howard is right that the defense team will attempt to make this case about MSHA. And that has a major impact if the potential jurors don't have any familiarity whatsoever with MSHA.
Attorney Mike Hissom with Bailey & Glasser, NPR's Howard Berkus, thank you both for joining us, and we look forward to checking in with you throughout this trial.
Thank you, Ashton.
Thanks, Ashton.
Ashton Mara and the rest of us here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting will be reporting daily from the courtroom as Blankenship's trial progresses. You can hear those reports on the radio and on the blog and podcast, Blankenship on Trial. For that podcast, head to our website, wvpublic.org. This trial has a lot of importance for people here in southern West Virginia whose loved ones lost their lives in the Upper Big Branch mining disaster. Over the past 5 years, I've spent time with several families of the victims, especially Gary and Patty Quarles. In 2012, I checked in with them to see how life has changed since the death of their son, Gary Wayne Quarles.
If happened to kill a buck, he'd come on the radio. Hey, Dad. I've shot one. He'd tear him all to pieces. I don't care if he'd done killed 50.
Patty and Gary Quarles remember their son as a jokester and an outdoorsman.
He was tore all to pieces. Hey, Dad. I've got one down. I don't know how good I've shot him, but I've got him. I'm going to look for him. I said, well, I'm coming to you.
And then he walked through this back door here like he was king on earth, and he'd say, BBD, big back down. And he always was going on about something.
But 2 years ago yesterday, everything changed.
She said, if I call your name, you are to report to Whitesville Fire Department to identify bodies.
And just as though she was talking about naming your cattle. I mean, that's exactly what she said. No, just come and identify your bodies.
When names started to be naming, there was people falling in the floor.
They sat in a room among the chaos, waiting for confirmation that their son was dead. Patty remembers when then-CEO Don Blankenship walked into the room.
He never looked out at any family. He looked straight ahead.
Yeah.
Never had a tear, there was nothing to him. I mean, you talk about cold.
Gary Wayne Quarles was 33 years old. But he really never left home. He lived next door to his parents.
If he was on the evening shift, he was here of the morning. If he was on the day shift, he was here of the evening. He ate. It's different. I mean, our whole entire life changed. From the time we wake up and we go to sleep, we're dealing better with it. But it's not right. It's not the same. I don't see how it can possibly ever be right again. But we try to deal with it. We don't have no choice. It's all the time something. But day to day, I deal pretty good. I deal pretty good. Like I said, that's two choices I have. I can sit, and sometimes that's more or less all I do. Just sit and watch TV. There's no reason to get up. There's no reason to cook. There's no reason to clean the house.
During the past session, the West Virginia legislature passed a law meant to improve mine safety in the state. But like so many coalfield residents, Patty is skeptical it will even matter.
They've got so many things that they have changed and that they're doing right now. The thing is, unless they are there to enforce these laws that they're passing, that they're making, it's not going to do any good. They had laws that should have protected those guys from a lot of things. But, you know, if it's not enforced, then you're going to have another UBB.
Patty says lawmakers and regulators are simply out of touch with what really happens in mining communities.
The government, when it comes to coal mining, I can't speak about anything else. They are not down here in the southern part of West Virginia where all these miners are. They do not have a clue. They'll tell you. My great-grandfather was a coal miner, or somebody else's brother, sister was a coal miner, but they personally do not have any coal mining experience. And these are the people that are left to make these deciding laws.
Prosecutors charged former chief of security and the superintendent in relation to the disaster. But Gary and Patty are still looking for justice.
These people that called the shots that got my son killed is the ones I'd like to see go to jail. That security guard, yeah, maybe he did lie, you know. Me and you have too. And I want the real people that's at real fault for this explosion to have to answer. And as of right now, it's very frustrating because they haven't. 2 years later, they still haven't.
And it don't look like it's going to ever happen. I, myself, don't feel like it will happen. They can say what they want to. They got Gary May talking and all this and that, but he's nobody either, you know.
Along with their attorney, the family of another UBB victim, Dean Jones, filed a complaint earlier this week against Blankenship, former Chief Operating Officer Chris Adkins, and former Vice President of Safety Elizabeth Chamberlain, among six others. The family accuses former Massey executives of deliberately causing emotional distress and demands punitive and compensatory damages. The case does not target the company or its new owner, Alpha Natural Resources. Late last year, Alpha agreed to a $210 million settlement with the federal government. The agreement requires the company to focus more resources on mine safety. Still, Patty and Gary hold on to little hope that Blankenship, along with other upper management, are charged in relation to the 29 miners' deaths. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Montcoal. Last year, after Don Blankenship was indicted, I got back in touch with Gary Quarles. He told me he was glad to hear the news that charges had been filed.
Why is this so important to you to have him criminally charged with this?
Well, he was the ringleader of it all. He called all the shots. If you listen and watch over big companies, you hardly ever hear the CEO's name. Don Blankenship's name was known throughout Massey by all the membership, by everybody. Don Blankenship was known. He made himself known, and so since he was, he should be the man in charge. That's what he wanted. So since he's the man in charge, he's the man to blame. Daddy Don is the man. He's a top man, and everybody was afraid of him. What Don said, that's the way it went.
This past week, I called Gary again. He told me that he and his wife plan on being at the Blankenship trial and are going to try to attend as many days as possible.
I know of things that, you know, you read about Don Blankenship, and you know about Don Blankenship by reading things that he's done with his money. And I'm hoping that nothing like that in this trial has ever happened, will ever happen. And then when the trial begins and when it ends, then if he wins, he wins. And if we win, we win. I can feel like that it was straight and honest, fair, and there ain't nothing else you can do about it. Go on home and you've done the best you can. And I've got a lot of confidence in Steve Ruby and Boot Goodwin. I really do. And I think we'll come out on top.
Again, that was Gary Quarles, who lost his son, Gary Wayne Quarles, in the Upper Big Branch disaster in 2010.
And the angels up in heaven mourn the 29 that fell in Montcalm, Virginia.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from NPR, Apple Shop, and WCHS Television. Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Jake Sheps, Alan Cathead Johnston and Stacy Grubb with Montcoal, West Virginia, and Catherine Clare, who performed Miner's Lullaby, written by James Lowe. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.